This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Some of the fiercest fights in this presidential campaign are taking place in America's suburbs. That's because half of all voters live there. President Trump has directly targeted the burbs in his political messaging, including last night when he tweeted, quote, "Biden supports Cory Booker's bill that will force low-income housing in the suburbs, which will lower property values and bring crime to your neighborhoods. If Dems win, goodbye suburbs," end quote. But the suburbs are complicated. While big cities trend more Democratic and rural areas trend more Republican, the modern suburb is a rich mix of political leanings. Take, for instance, the urban suburb, like Wheaton, Maryland, on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. 1A's national correspondent, Sasha Ann Simons, takes us there now to learn more.
Wheaton, Maryland, got its name back in the late 1800s after Major General Frank Wheaton, a military officer who served in the Civil War and American Indian Wars. Back then, the area resembled a thinly settled countryside. Today, the suburb just 10 miles outside of D.C. is densely populated. Wheaton has a mix of apartment buildings and single-family homes. There are plenty of parks, gigantic trees, and the area is home to more than 50,000 residents. Most of them vote blue. And at the end of one quiet street is where you'll find Wendy Howard.
Did turn out to be a nice day, though, didn't it?
Sure did.
Wendy bought this house 18 years ago. She shares it with her Chiweeny miniature dog and elderly mother Angela, who just peeked out the door to join our chat.
So nice to meet you.
Yes, same here. Did she tell you we love the show?
Oh, thank you.
When it came time to purchase in 2002, Wendy says buying in Wheaton rather than Washington was an easy choice.
The restaurants, the people, the neighborhoods, the history. So I love this area.
Roughly 69 million people across the country live in what demographers classify as urban-suburban areas. And over the past two decades, they've changed dramatically. In Maryland, for instance, downtown Wheaton's busy streets are packed with restaurants ranging from Salvadoran to Italian to Vietnamese. Recent redevelopment projects have led to struggles over the displacement of immigrants and small businesses, though some fought back. Wendy's family is part of Wheaton's nearly 20% of African Americans. And she hopes they all get a fair shake in the upcoming presidential election.
I can really only talk about what is important to me. So that is really health care, the health of our residents. For me, equity is a really big thing. As we talked about this diverse population, two blocks away, you know, we have single family homes with multifamilies in them. I know they were hard hit when this pandemic hit. Hit a lot of the kids, you know, were getting their lunch at school. And now all of a sudden, there was no school for them to get lunch. So the county implemented a lot of good plans to do that. But this was a concern. These are my neighbors.
Climate change also tops Wendy's list of important issues. And according to Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project at George Washington University, Wendy sounds a lot like many urban suburban residents.
Of these three suburban types we're talking about, they're the wealthiest. They're the best educated, and they're the ones that are really the least like suburbs. They're the ones that are increasingly like the city. And they're full of people that want that environment.
And just like the big cities, Dante says life in the urban suburbs has its peaks and valleys.
They have high college education rates, but they have increasing levels of illiteracy because there are pockets in them. They're more urban. There are pockets of them that have poverty now.
Suburban women are a coveted voting demographic. They were key to President Donald Trump's win in 2016, and they're shaping up to be a pivotal demographic in this year's election, too. In his own appeals to suburban voters, President Trump has tweeted to protect, quote, suburban housewives, and says that Joe Biden will destroy their neighborhoods and American dreams.
They don't want to have their American dream fulfilled and then have a low-income housing project built right next to their house or in the neighborhood.
But the picture President Trump paints of the American suburb, affluent, homogenous, and fearful of cities, is one pulled from the history books.
Your home will go down in value and crime rates will rapidly rise. Joe Biden and his bosses from the radical left want to significantly multiply what they're doing now. And what will be the end result is you will totally destroy the beautiful suburbs. Suburbia will be no longer as we know it.
While he characterizes the suburbs as the pinnacle of the American dream, according to Bloomberg, poverty is rising faster there than in cities. And what about housewives? These days, fewer suburban women fit that description, too. We're driving through the state of Maryland from Montgomery County to Prince George's County. On this early morning, I stopped in Hyattsville, another urban suburb near Washington. Take a quick scan of this neighborhood and you'll see rainbow flags on lawns, several Biden-Harris campaign signs, and Black Lives Matter messages on front porches and windows. We'll hear from a neighborhood resident in a moment, but first, some more context from Dante Chinney at George Washington University.
Yeah, I think the thing I think that surprised a lot of people this year is the general, there was this question of like, well, Black Lives Matter, what's going to happen once that bubbles through? Like, what are white voters going to think of Black Lives Matter? And then surprise, surprise, polling data showed that white voters tended to agree with it. That's in large part because of urban whites and whites in the urban suburbs. They can't believe what they're seeing with their eyes, even though it's been going on for a while. But something opened their eyes about it this year that made them feel differently.
Okay, back to the urban suburb of Hyattsville, Maryland, just 6 miles from D.C. It's where Nancy DeMeo has lived with her wife, Drenna, for 13 years. Though serious health concerns forced them to skip crowded protests amid a pandemic, Nancy affirms, as two white women, they care deeply about racial injustice in America.
Today I'm upset because of the man in Texas who was killed yesterday. So, right now it's top of mind.
Jonathan Price.
Yes. And the man who was killed in Rochester. It is systemic, and I think people watching the life go out of George Floyd, it galvanized everybody because everybody was a witness and you could not look away.
Less than half a block away lives Katie Ablard and her partner Marcy. Like Nancy, this couple plans on voting early for Joe Biden. And as Election Day draws near, Katie says they've joined neighborhood volunteers mailing postcards to encourage Democratic voters in Virginia and Georgia to cast their ballots.
And then there's some people doing phone banking also. And one of the things that is part of the training is if a person says they're undecided, there's certain script that you say if someone is undecided. And some of us were kind of wondering, we might go off script if someone actually tells us that they're undecided, because at this point, what are you undecided about? How could you be undecided?
Katie acknowledged that there are what she described as a handful of Republican households nearby. But polls show that former Vice President Joe Biden is leading President Trump in key swing states. That's largely because women voters are providing the lopsided boost Biden needs in order to beat Trump. In 2016, Donald Trump won the overall suburban vote by 5 percentage points. These votes were largely responsible for his narrow victories in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And his path to 4 more years runs through the same territory. Although it appears his views about the burbs and suburban women haven't changed much, have these voters changed their minds about him? For 1A, I'm Sasha Ann Simons.
Thanks for that, Sasha. Now let's turn to the latest polling on suburban voters. Joining us here in Washington is Dave Wasserman. He's the House editor for the Cook Political Report. Dave, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what's your reaction to what we just heard? Does this square with what we're seeing with suburban voters?
Absolutely. You know, the suburbs don't all look alike. Some have Whole Foods markets and Lululemons. Others have Hobby Lobbies and Dollar Generals. Some are heavily white. Some are rapidly getting more diverse and are melting pots. What we've seen over the past few years is that the divide has become more stark across lines of college education. And highly college-educated suburbs are trending blue, while more blue-collar and working-class suburbs have stagnated for Democrats or may even be trending red in some cases. What's unique about this election in 2020 is that Biden has been successful in turning back the clock in some of the more working-class suburbs and restoring his polling closer to where Democrats were during the Obama-Biden years. But he's also maintained Democratic advances in some of the more upscale suburbs. And there are places like Morris County, New Jersey, and Collin County, Texas, that used to be bedrock Republican suburbs of major metro areas that are now in jeopardy of flipping to Democrats.
Is there a particular area around the country that we could look at as a microcosm of how voters in the suburbs and exurbs will vote in this election?
Well, there are really several different types of suburbs, as Dante alluded to. But just to give you an idea, so in Plano, Texas, which is experiencing a rate of corporate relocations that's hard to fathom, they're now home to the headquarters of Toyota North America and Frito-Lay, among others. That's a county that Mitt Romney carried by 32 points back in 2012. It voted for Donald Trump by only 16 points, about half that margin, in 2016. And polls suggest that it's pretty close to a toss-up today. You also have some more diverse suburbs, places like Miami, where Trump is doing marginally better among Hispanic suburban voters than he did in 2016. So there are a variety of trends underway.
We're talking to Dave Wasserman. He's the House editor for the Cook Political Report, and we'll have lots more with him right after a short break. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Swell. Swell is a place for thoughtful audio conversations that are unlike anything you've experienced. Interact with authors, celebrity chefs, teachers, artists, CEOs, or connect with new people from all over the world. Listen on Swell for fresh ideas and perspectives. And once you're comfortable with the app, start a new conversation by posting a Swell of your own. Swell is free in the App Store and on Google Play. From technologists to podcasters, interesting people are talking on Swell.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
I'm Rodney Carmichael.
I'm Sydney Madden.
And on our new podcast, Louder Than a Riot, we trace the collision of rhyme and punishment in America.
We were hunted by police. We were literally physically hunted. You'd be standing on the corner, drug squad pull up, everybody will run.
New from NPR Music. Listen to Louder Than a Riot.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're talking about suburban voters with Dave Wasserman, the House editor for the Cook Political Report. We got this email from Patricia who says, how can you discuss suburbs without clarifying the race of the residents? And Dave, you touched on this right before the break, but talk a little bit more about some of the shifts we've seen in the racial makeup of suburbs over time.
Well, it's a great question. And what we've observed is that as suburbs have become more diverse, more African-American and Asian and Hispanic residents have on balance contributed towards suburbs trending blue. But President Trump is doing marginally better among younger African-American men than he did in 2016. The biggest erosion for Democrats we've seen is among Hispanic voters. And as I alluded to, as opposed to 2016, when Trump's version of outreach to Latino voters was to essentially tweet a picture of a taco bowl and said, I love Hispanics. This time he actually is running a robust Spanish language ad campaign, and it's paying dividends in more Hispanic suburbs of the country. But when I look at House races, which I cover on a daily basis, what I've seen is that some traditionally red suburbs of metro areas are really changing at a rapid rate. And places like the Cincinnati suburbs, St. Louis, Indianapolis, Omaha, San Antonio, Phoenix, these are all places where Democrats stand a strong chance of picking up congressional seats in suburbs that were once thought of as unthinkable pickup opportunities.
And when you talk about them changing, do you mean in terms of their racial makeup?
Well, it's a combination of added diversity, but also a concentration of college graduates who've moved to these job-rich metro areas and are living in the same types of places. And just to give you an idea, back in 2007, when Democrats had the exact same number of seats in the House they do today, they held 50 of the country's wealthiest 100 districts. Today, they hold 79 of the country's 100 wealthiest districts, and it's strongly correlated with having a college degree. Mm-hmm.
Well, in 2016, President Trump won the overall suburban vote by 5 percentage points. How important is this voting bloc for him this election? Is it even fair to call it a bloc anymore?
Well, it's a very large bloc, and so it's not easy to stereotype. But urbanicity is an increasingly good indicator of where Democrats are doing well, and that partially explains why we're seeing states like Arizona and Texas, which had historically been Republican states, trend towards Democrats, and Biden has a very good chance of winning Arizona this year. Whereas states that have a larger small town and rural component, such as Wisconsin and Michigan, are on a long-term trajectory, becoming more competitive. And although Biden is ahead there today, the overall trend line is favorable to Republicans.
We've been focusing mostly on the presidential race, but how are these shifts in the suburbs shaping congressional races?
So what we've seen in particular districts is a wide disparity between the party's messaging towards suburban voters. We're seeing Republicans trying to portray Democrats as the party of defunding the police in a lot of places. In St. Louis, Missouri, the suburbs there, there's a very competitive House seat. Republican Ann Wagner, who's been there for five terms, she is accusing the Democrat, State Senator Jill Shoup, of voting for legislation that she said would allow sex offenders to coach youth sports. But Shoup has countered that by arguing that Wagner has voted with Trump over 90% of the time. This is a district that voted for Trump by 10 in 2016, but where Biden is ahead today, according to both parties' polls. And it's the Democrats' attack that could actually be more damaging.
Well, as we heard in Sasha's reporting, back in August, the president tweeted about the suburban housewife and low-income housing, to use his word, invading neighborhoods. He tweeted something similar last night. Many are reading these as racist dog whistles intended to scare his base. What do we know about current attitudes among suburban white women who voted for President Trump in 2016?
Republicans could be headed for catastrophe with suburban white women, particularly those with college degrees. There are two groups where we're seeing the biggest drop-off in support for Trump since 2016, and those are seniors and especially blue-collar white women. And keep in mind that there were a number of suburban white women in the upper Midwest who had voted for Democrats over the years, but voted for Donald Trump in 2016 because he downplayed traditional wedge issues like abortion and gay marriage, but played up issues like trade and immigration, where they shared some commonality in points of view. This time around, with the Supreme Court vacancy and with a lot of the messaging coming from the White House, the focus is more on the Affordable Care Act, on Roe v. Wade, and a lot of these suburban women do not want to see either overturned. And as a result, that's put more distance between Republicans and the voters they need.
When you zoom out a bit and you think about the fact that the suburbs are diversifying, they're changing, how do candidates have to rethink their political messaging to reach as broad a scope of potential voter as they can?
You know, what's fascinating is when we look at the focus group data coming from a variety of organizations who are spending in 2020, what they're seeing is that on the Democratic side, at least, direct attacks on Trump are falling flat with some of the swing or persuadable voters who are remaining in suburban America. What tends to move them is messaging around education and issues like raising the minimum wage and Social Security, more majoritarian economic policies. And if there's a message that's been testing off the charts with suburban women in particular that isn't getting much attention in D.C., it's Democrats' call to fire Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education.
Well, we'll have to take another quick break, but we'll have more with Dave Wasserman on the suburbs and how they might affect the upcoming elections after this. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Talkspace. Your mental health is priceless, but getting support shouldn't cost a fortune. At a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy, Talkspace connects you to a licensed therapist you can message with 24/7 from the privacy of your mobile device. So you get the support you need at a price you can afford. Get $100 off your first month with promo code 1A at Talkspace.com or when you download the app.
Billie Holiday helped shape American music with her voice and unique style.
But her legacy extends way beyond music, with one song in particular.
How Strange Fruit became an unexpected hit and brought on serious consequences for Billie Holiday.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
This is 1A. We're continuing our conversation on the complex nature of American suburbs. And Dan, I wanted to ask, we've talked about the changing racial dynamics in the suburbs, but what about income? Where does that come into play?
Well, income is a pretty strongly inverted category compared to what we might have seen 20 years ago. Democrats are gaining a lot of ground with wealthier suburbanites. And that doesn't just have the effect of moving those parts of the suburbs towards Democrats and voting habits, but we're also seeing Democrats with a mammoth fundraising advantage in these races down ballot, because Democrats are increasingly the party of suburbanites who are vehemently anti-Trump, anti-McConnell, and happen to have a lot of disposable income.
And when we think about the makeup of suburbs and people's income, how is that shifting and reshaping these areas?
So what we've seen in the past 30 years is a clustering of professionals in white-collar jobs in certain suburbs. A lot of it has to do with moving to places where schools are rated highly. And that has caused a lot of formerly Republican places to become competitive. But it's also created resentment in other suburbs that are older, more white ethnic bedroom communities for law enforcement officers and fire and first responders. And those types of suburbs are increasingly difficult for Democrats to win.
Well, yesterday, the Cook Political Report moved the status of the South Carolina Senate race to toss up. Talk a bit more about what's happening in that race and how the changing suburbs are having an impact on them.
Yes. Well, as our Senate editor, Justice Taylor, wrote, the South Carolina Senate race is really being driven by changing attitudes in South Carolina's suburbs. It's not just Charleston, but it's also Columbia and the areas south of Charlotte, which are a growing component of South Carolina's vote. South Carolina has traditionally been so racially polarized that it's difficult for a Democrat to get near 50%. But Democrats did win a congressional seat in a big upset in the Charleston area in 2018. That Democrat, Joe Cunningham, looks headed for re-election. And increasingly, it's those types of places that are powering Jamie Harrison's chances against Lindsey Graham in the Senate race.
What other races are you watching closely?
Well, we've got a few dozen very heated House races that are mostly playing out in suburban settings. One that we're watching closely is in Ohio's first congressional district. Steve Chabot, a Republican who's been there for over 20 years, is facing off against a Cincinnati health commissioner named Kate Schroeder. And that district is one where if you did have a large turnout among African Americans, many of whom have moved outside the city limits of Cincinnati, and you had a big migration of wealthier white voters in places like Warren County from red to blue, that's a district that Democrats could end up winning. So there are a variety of places, including Salt Lake City, including the northern Phoenix suburbs, the Indianapolis suburbs, where Democrats are in a good position to flip seats that we never would have guessed could go their way.
We got this email from Ann who says, I live in a fifth outer ring suburb outside Minneapolis, Minnesota. I think many people in my community voted Trump in 2016, not knowing what to expect. I don't think he's doing as well in 2020. My Republican neighbors don't want to vote for him this election. There are some Trump signs in yards, but I'm seeing more and more Biden-Harris signs in my area. Dave, when we think about this presidential election, what issues from the Republican Party are resonating with suburban voters, and which ones aren't?
So Republicans have to walk a fine line because clearly their president is espousing messages that are falling flat in the suburbs right now. And there are a number of Republican candidates I've seen who are talking about very different things from the president. For example, State Senator Stephanie Bice, who's running in Oklahoma City, she talks about fighting to increase pay for teachers in her ads. Nick Freitas, who's running in the Richmond suburbs against Democratic freshman Abigail Spanberger, he's wearing a mask in his ad, and he's advocating for mask wearing. And so Republicans are trying to make clear in many of these suburbs that they're their own person and their own brand separate from the president, because they know how poorly he's performing at the moment.
You know, Dan, we're just a few weeks out from the election at this point. What do both parties need to do in this final push to try to connect with suburban voters who may still be undecided? It's hard to believe there are still undecided voters this close to the election. But, you know, what are you listening for from both campaigns?
So one of the attacks that we're seeing across the board on the Republican side is that Democrats want to defund the police. Now, in most cases, including Joe Biden's, that is false. But one thing I'm watching from Democrats in suburban races is the extent to which they feature law enforcement or support from sheriffs or police chiefs to try and blunt that line of attack from Republicans. And when Democrats have talked about law and order, they've typically done well in the polling that I've seen. On Long Island, for example, there's an open seat in the 2nd District in Nassau County, and Democrats are running a veteran named Jackie Gordon, who was born in Jamaica. She's a Babylon councilwoman who talks in her ad about how she's served as a military police officer. That's a district that many people I've heard say would be reluctant to vote for an African-American Democrat, but she's actually polling quite strongly at the moment.
And I think that's all the time we have. That's Dave Wasserman. He's the House editor for the Cook Political Report. Dave, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's show was produced by Catherine Fink and Sasha Ann Simons and edited by Matthew Simonson. You can learn all about them and the rest of the team at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.